Today's Teisho will be on Case 18 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 18 is entitled Tozan's Three Chin of Flax. A monk asked Tozan, "What is Buddha?" Tozan replied, "Three Chin of Flax." Mumon's comment: old Tozan attained the poor zen of a clam. He opened the two halves of the shell a little and exposed all his liver and intestines. But tell me, how do you see Tozan? Mumon's verse: 3 pounds of flax came sweeping along. Close were the words, but closer was the meaning. Those who argue about right and wrong are enslaved by right and wrong. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This has been a beautiful August and a beautiful autumn. These days are really amazing for New Jersey. Usually at this time of the year, it's oppressively hot and humid. Sometimes the temperature doesn't go down at night at all. It can be 80 degrees at night. A difficult time of the year for many people. But for some reason, you know, this has just been the most glorious month. And we have all the beauty of a late summer, and yet it's cool and low humidity. It's just amazing. So everybody got up this morning and came here to practice Zen. You may not really know why you did it. You know, if somebody asked you, you might say that you're interested in enlightenment or something like that. But probably any reason you gave would just be an excuse. You know, maybe the truest answer you could give would just be, because I want to. But why do you want to? I think that's really interesting. a few years ago, actually a fair number of years ago, my neighbors, Fidel and Keith, decided to build a pond in their backyard. And they wanted me to be involved in the project too, so I did. They built a pond, and I built a pond right next to it, and we created a little stream, and their yard is a little higher than our yard. So there's a little stream bed, and basically they were both tech people. They were both, one was an engineer and the other was an IT person. So they were able to create this system, this plumbing system, where there was an artificial waterfall, and the water would come off the waterfall into their pond, and then it would flow down this little stream bed into our pond, and then there was a hidden drain pipe and pump that would pull it back and send it back up over into the waterfall. So there'd be this continuous stream of water. And then when the pond was all done, we spent many days digging these big holes in our backyard. And we went out to northern New Jersey and found a bunch of rocks. There was a big road project up there. And I asked the foreman, I go up there to teach meditation. And on the way up there one day, I saw some construction people. And I said, what if I just took some of these rocks? They said, take all the rocks you want. So Fidel, Keith, and I drove up there, and we loaded a big truck with rocks and brought them all back and made this beautiful pond. And then we bought some koi, some fish for the pond. And, you know, as soon as we put the koi in the pond, it was hypnotic, you know. I would get up in the morning and sit, and then I would go out in the backyard, and there were Fidel and Keith. This is like at 6 o'clock in the morning, looking at their fish. And then, you know, they sold their house, and they moved away, and new people came in, John and Patrick. And I would get up in the morning, and I would look, and John would be out there watching the fish. And I myself love to watch fish. So before I go to work, I try to take like 10 minutes and just sit and be with my fish. And when I come home, if it's not dark, I'll go out and I actually ask my wife, how are the fish? You know, good. Then we go out and look, okay, let's go feed the fish. And you sit at the edge of this pond, and you know the pond is fairly clear, but even though it's about 4 feet deep, there isn't complete visibility. So, you know, the fish move in and out of the shadows, and they come from the depths up to the surface. So, you know, you're watching these fish move in and out of shadow, appear and disappear, and come to the surface. And you know, if you feed your fish, they become very receptive. They'll come right up, especially koi, will almost walk out of the water to get some food. And it's very cute. You know, they'll come right up and you can feed them with your hand. Why is this so entrancing? You know, there's something about this that just is deeply entrancing. You know? And even people who are sort of fish skeptics, you know, if they have the chance, you know, to just look at fish like this, it's very, very... it draws you in somehow to a different state of mind, you know. And it's quite dependable, you know. So, you know, the other day, my wife and I went to this, there's a New Jersey State Arboretum up near PPAC it's off of 206 or 202. And, you know, the place was packed with people. And it's an exquisite, you know, if you like gardens and you like forests, it's just an amazing place. And people just, there are miles and miles of trails. And people just walk down these forest paths looking at the trees and looking at the leaves. You know, it's people spend their whole day there. And we were talking to this man who said, yes, you know, I always come here once a year. It's like a pilgrimage for me, you know. And I understand exactly what he means, you know. It's in a beautiful area, this sort of rolling hills. And then, you know, you go into this forest and the whole arboretum is built along this stream bed. And there's trees of every kind, and you turn the corner, and then there's another kind of tree. And, you know, each tree has a little tag on it, and if you're interested in knowing all the different kinds, you can look at the tag and write it down. But I'm not kidding, there were hundreds of people there. And you think, what's going on, you know? Why are all these people driving up to central New Jersey to look at trees? You know, you can see a tree in your backyard. What's the point? But, you know, there's something... I used the word hypnotic about watching fish. And, you know, again, there's something sort of like hypnotic. It's really not hypnotic, I think, but it's like that. You know, you're walking through this forest. The light is coming through the trees. The ground is shadow and light. You turn a corner and there's this tree that's just amazing somehow. You know, it has interesting flowers or interesting bark. And then, you know, you go around another corner and there's another surprise. You know, people are entranced by this. A few months ago, I went to a show at the MoMA in New York. It was early abstraction, early modern abstraction, and there were thousands of people there. You know, and it's an incredibly good show. I would recommend it to anybody who's interested in 20th century art. And some of the rooms were so packed that you could hardly move. And I remember coming into this one room that had these paintings, big paintings. And the paintings were basically big areas of color. So there'd be a big area of like screaming orange, and a smaller area like a rectangle of kind of a cobalt blue, you know, with some greens, some green squares on one side, and so on. And people were walking along these canvases, looking at these squares of color, or these people had thrown paint on canvas and these splotches. And absolutely, at one point, it was absolutely still. And the room was absolutely, people were sort of like in awe. You know, in these cases, you know, we don't pay necessarily much attention to this dimension of life. As you know, I like to hike. And a few years ago, I had a chance to do the Teton Crest Trail in Montana. In Wyoming. The first part of that trail is almost 45 degree angle for like 6 hours. But it was 45 degree angle for 6 hours in this this mountainside that was covered with flowers. So you're looking at a mountain that is like, I don't know, 30 miles of flowers, right? And you're walking through 30 miles of flowers to get to the top of this big mountain. You know, I have to say, even though I get a lot of exercise carrying this heavy pack, it was about a 40-pound pack, and it was a hot day. And my friend Larry is like this outdoorsman. He's in incredible shape. He's an amazing specimen. And you know, I had to get him to stop once in a while, and I was covered with sweat. You know, but I wouldn't not have done that. You know, and my legs hurt. By the time I got to the top, I was really tired. And I was drenched in sweat. But I'm so glad I did it. And when I looked around, you could see for like, I don't know, 80 miles, you know, the Teton Mountains. And you could see all the way over to the Yellowstone peaks. You know, we don't pay much attention to this dimension of life. But it's very important. It's really hugely important. You know, we live in a small world a lot of the time. It's the world of consciousness. So, you know, I was in my job yesterday, and I had to do a lot of different things that were difficult. You know, I had to do a report, had to get this report finished. And I've been doing a lot of copy editing. I have this project that has to, and so, you know, you'll write something and it goes to the editor, and then the editor makes suggestions and sends it back. And I've been working with hundreds of pages of copy edited material. And you know, you have to be on your toes. You have to focus. You have to read carefully. You're looking for mistakes. You're looking, you know, and the editor makes comments, and you have to read the comments. You can't miss them. And then you have to get out maybe your dictionary and think about what word you're going to use or how to rewrite some sentence. And, you know, this is sort of how we spend a lot of our time. We spend a lot of our time in that world, you know, the thinking world. And you know, if you do a lot of work with your mind, you know, you might be a doctor or a lawyer. You might be a scientist. You know, if you might be a writer or an editor. You know, you spend that lot of time in that world. You know, and even if you're if you're sort of action oriented, you know, like carpenter, plumber, something like that. You know, you mostly think a lot about, you know, when you look at a problem, you think about it, you focus, and it's a problem-solving mentality, you know. So, especially in the modern world, we think a lot. We believe in ideas, and we believe in this kind of processing that we call thinking. And if you think about it, our whole educational system is just an educational system in thinking, basically. All the tools for thinking. So, you know, we spend 12 years sitting in a room learning mathematics and reading poetry and writing about poetry. And we learn geography and history, and we learn how to commit ideas to paper, you know, to recite what we've learned. When I was in the seventh grade, we had to recite the names of all the presidents. And that, believe it or not, in the state of Virginia, that was a requirement for passing the seventh grade. So we had a certain time of the year where we had to recite the names of the presidents. And a couple times I would just get so tangled up. There's President Harrison, and after Harrison, my mind would just go blank, you know. So I finally got through the seventh grade. But, you know, it's odd in a way that all of our education and all of our formal training is the life of the mind. And the life, it's odd because the life of the mind is such a small part of our world, you know? So, we don't really have an educational system that teaches us how to be intelligent emotionally. Or that makes us aware of all these other dimensions of experience that really make life valuable, you know. If you like trees and you go to the New Jersey State Arboretum, you know, if you say, what are you accomplishing or what are you doing? You know, it'd be hard to say, really. You know, so what have you accomplished by doing this? You know, maybe nothing, but somehow it's a very deep experience. You know, if you go hiking, you know, you burn off a lot of calories, you look at some mountains, what are you really accomplishing, you know? And our education doesn't really teach us how to appreciate or how to understand what's going on on those occasions. Thinking is so central to our culture. It's what our schooling is all about, and it's also what our system rewards to an incredible degree, you know. That we, in a way, we're sort of like ignorant about every other part of our lives except that one part. And if you want to understand what we're doing here at a place like this, you could think of this as a school, you know, maybe like a school for what I would say is really like the deeper part of yourself, the deeper part of yourself. You know, we all get our 12 years of education and thinking, and then we go to college and we go to graduate school and do even more thinking. And after a while, we sort of believe that this is reality. This is what it's all about. And we depend on our thinking, we depend on our ideas, and we need to be good at that. There's no question about it. But if we're not very careful, we get a really distorted picture of what life is all about, because thinking is really just like a little compartment in something bigger. And I think that when people go hiking, or when they look at fish in a pond, or they watch birds, or when they make delicious food, or when they paint or write poetry, they're doing something else that's not thinking. You know, it's really, I think, more important. or at least as important as the thinking part. I went on my first hike when I was 12 years old. I joined the Boy Scouts because I had to. My father decided he wanted to be a scoutmaster. And so once he joined the Scouts, we had to join the Scouts. I was a terrible scout. I was very scattered, and I don't think if I was a very disorganized little kid. And so when we would show up for inspection, we would have like an inspection. We'd all have to come in our scout uniform. I always was missing something. The socks this would fall down, or I was just a mess. But the scoutmaster took us out on, the scoutmaster, my father, and the other scoutmaster, Mr. Sayre, decided to take the whole troop on this hike in the Appalachian Mountains. And, in many ways it was absolutely torture because I had never done anything like this. I was totally out of shape. And yet, there was something magical about that, being outside, being in a beautiful Appalachian Mountains, it really changed my life, I guess. I didn't accomplish anything. I'm not sure I learned anything. What did you learn? Well, I learned, I don't know what I learned, I learned it really hurts to walk 10 miles a day. It hurts your feet, And my feet were all covered with blisters. I had to put Band-Aids all over my feet. At the end of it, it was just, this is so wonderful. I think we have these experiences where the boundary between ourself and the world begins to dissolve. And, normally we have this very, fairly rigid boundary that we create. As we're growing up, we create this like rigid boundary between ourself and the world. And it's partly, a defense mechanism, right? It's a defense mechanism. We get hurt, other people hurt us. They hurt our feelings or they physically hurt us. And we create kind of like this sort of invisible suit of armor we carry around with us. I also think we maintain a kind of a boundary in another way too, a psychological boundary. Most people learn how to space out. We learn how to space out. So, I remember being in a math class in the eighth grade, actually algebra. And I was a terrible algebra student for the first, half of the class. I finally figured out algebra. But I failed a lot of the tests and quizzes in algebra the first part of the year. And I remember going into algebra and just being so unhappy and so embarrassed that I was such a terrible student. And I would just sort of disappear into my head. I'd try to focus on these equations, and I would just sort of go into my head. And in my head, I would be somewhere else. I'd be walking through the woods, or I'd think about, there was this beautiful girl I was in love with, I'd think about her. Or I'd think about other things, And then I would, I'd realize I haven't been paying attention to how we learn how to space out, to disappear. And this also creates a sense of separation. But I think sometimes, we have these experiences that begin to dissolve the boundary between ourselves and the world. And this is a fright, can be frightening, but also it can be, and it can even be a little painful sometimes, but also it can be, once it happens, it's very, very beautiful, very liberating. And I think something like hiking is like that, It's very painful, your legs hurt, you get blood blisters on your feet. But then, you have these moments where you're just totally lifted outside yourself, and you feel this deep, it's like you're no longer just living your life, you're living the life of the world. I'm sure you've had moments like that, where it's no longer your life, it's the life of the world. And you know, sometimes people don't have these experiences very often. And sometimes because they don't have these experiences, they begin to look for them in the wrong places, you know. So lots of people become, say, alcoholics, have problems with drinking, because that's the only way they can get out of this small world of thinking and begin to have this bigger sense of living the life of the world, you know. I have to say, a lot of people in my family had drinking problems. My dad was a truly alcoholic. And, you know, when he was, he was an incredibly wonderful guy if he'd been drinking to a point. And I have seen him in a room having had something to drink, and he just lit up the room. He would be smiling, he would be so, people loved him, you know, because his boundaries were down, and he would have this real genuine sense of love for other people. That it was not a good strategy. It had a lot of negative consequences for him. But people, I think people long for getting outside the small self, that world of thinking, and beginning to live the life of the universe, the life of the world, you know. So I think we crave this, you know. And one way to think about Zen practice is that it's like a school for getting outside the self and living the life of the universe, you know. And we don't really get that kind of education in school, in you know, formal schooling. But that's what this is all about, you know. And you know, I have to say, we just finished a wonderful sesshin. We had a wonderful August sesshin, and I think 26 or 27 people attended some portion of it. And, you know, I woke up one morning and I went into the Zendo and I thought to myself, you know, this is the most amazing institution. I don't know who invented sesshin. You know, but by day four or day three of a sesshin, people have really changed. You know, they really change. They go through this transformation process. You know, a day one of sesshin, we all have to, if you've been to sesshin, you know, we have all of our bowls in a stack on the table. And when we eat, we take the cover off, then we take the napkin out, and then we put our bowls on the table. And, you know, the first day of sesshin, when everybody does this, it's such a racket, right? These plastic bowls are banging against each other, and it's just like this incredible racket as everybody takes their bowls apart, their bowl sets apart. By around day three of sesshin, it's a totally different experience. Everybody's quietly undoing, it's like they're very attentively separating their bowls and putting them on the table. It's very quiet. You know, it's not something people think about. You know, they probably don't even notice it. But I notice it. You know, there's a difference in the way people move and the way they interact. It's like your life becomes bigger and yourself becomes lighter. You know, and these bowls, you know, if you're totally caught up in your thinking, the world outside is barely there sometimes. Right, barely there. You know, this happens to me too. You know, sometimes I'll get so caught up in all this stuff, I'll suddenly realize, what time is it? It's, oh my God, it's 4:00. You know, what happened? You know, this happens to me too. But this is a style, a way of living. You know, we've created this way of living. You're so caught up in your head, the world outside seems very remote, very separate from you. You know, at sesshin, by around day two or day three of sesshin, suddenly everybody's treating the bowls in a different way. You know, they're not separate. You know, the room is not separate. You know, there's this sense of connect. It's not conscious. This unconscious presumption of connectedness. And so, you know, Sesshin brings about this transformation of consciousness which people might not even notice. But one way, from the Zen standpoint, would say, you know, people come to Sesshin with coarse minds. Coarse minds means so caught in thinking that the world around you seems very separate. See, that's a coarse mind. And gradually, as you go through the process of Sesshin, which is like the process of coming here to sit, you know, you are gradually opened up and reconnected to the world. My second teacher, Webb Sensei, has been to China many times. And he told us once that there was a temple in China that he went to, and on the gate of the temple, the character said, "Deep Zazen makes people not crude spirited. Deep Zazen makes people not crude spirited." See, I, if we ever have a building, I think I want those characters on the entryway. You know, when we come to sit in the morning or in the evening or when we come to Sesshin, you know, it's probably a good bet that we're rather crude-spirited to some degree or another, you know. Our minds are coarse. And, you know, you sit down on the cushion and basically it's like a process of refining or opening up. And it goes on and on. You get more and more open, and your consciousness becomes more and more connected. Now, you might not feel like this, right? You know, when you sit down on the cushion, you know, whatever is in there that's making you coarse is going to come out. So, you know, last night we had a very nice young man who came here to sit for the first time, and I said, "How did your meditation go?" And he said, "Not so well." I said, "Well, what's wrong?" And he said, "Well, I feel better now. I feel more relaxed. But, you know, my girlfriend and I just broke up, and it was very emotionally painful for me. And when I sat down on the cushion, I thought I was going to be in bliss, but instead all I could think about was how painful this was." You know, this is coarseness, right? And, you know, he, I think, had believed that he had put this behind him. But right under the surface of his mind was this hurt, this pain. It's right there. You know, when you sit down to do Zazen, whatever is in there is going to come out. You know, you're going to have to face whatever is in there. And, you know, in his case, you know, basically he's been carrying this around. He's starting college. He's carrying around this pain. He's in chemistry class, and he's doing chemistry, and right under the surface, there's this pain. And, you know, he's eating his lunch, and he's laughing with his friends, but right under the surface, there's this pain. You know, and this pain has the effect of making us separate from what's happening around us, you know. So when we sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath for a little while, and maybe you suddenly feel this, you know, he feels this, reliving these events. And I said, just keep coming back to your breath. You know, at some point, if you keep coming back to the breath, the emotional power of these events is going to drain away. And when he is aware of them, or when he remembers them, he's going to be doing it with a serene mind. You know, working through our obstacles in this way is absolutely essential. We usually don't do that, actually. You know, what we usually do is we try to put them somewhere. We try to squirrel them away somewhere in our mind. So, you know, if we are really having a hard time with a relationship and our girlfriend dumps us or our boyfriend dumps us, you know, we can go have a beer and get a little drunk. And we get up the next day and maybe we are doing our homework and so on, and we don't really think about the fact that it's still right under the surface, you know. We haven't really escaped it. So part of Zen practice is like mental hygiene. You sit down on the cushion and whatever is there is going to come out, and then you you have to move from that distress back to this very calm place inside yourself. Now, for beginners, the hard part is finding that calm place. You know, introductory Zen practice is getting to that calm place, finding there's a place inside yourself that's absolutely still and imperturbable. And, you know, if you keep practicing regularly, you'll get to this place that's absolutely still and imperturbable. And, in fact, it's also empty. Early Zen practice is finding that place. And then more advanced Zen practice is the daily hygiene of working from our distress to this calm place, moving back and forth until we're no longer in distress and the mind becomes clear. You know, when these sources of anxiety or distress no longer trigger these automatic responses, our relationship with the world is very different. You know, now when we are interacting, it's with a kind of openness and trust. So this is really the heart of Zen practice, is working through these obstacles and then getting to this place of openness and trust. When we're in this condition of openness and trust, you know, our relationships with the world are more spontaneous, more creative, and more compassionate. And not coarse. See, deep sitting makes people not crude spirited. So, this process of like refining consciousness or expanding consciousness can go on and on, on and on. The first level is finding this calm place in ourself and then learning how to use that calm place to deal with our obstacles, you know, our immediate day-to-day obstacles. More advanced Zen practice, sort of like regular koan practice that we do, involves basically working through our deeper obstacles. You know, there are obstacles that we just take with us onto the cushion from yesterday. And you sit down on the cushion and all this stuff is playing in your head and you come back to this calm place and gradually it stops triggering anger or fear or anxiety. You become calm. Okay, that's sort of everyday practice. Deeper practice is working with these deeper barriers in ourself that may be quite old and might have really had an impact on our life, you know? When I was growing up, for a while, my father worked in Baltimore, at a naval base in Baltimore, and I lived in Baltimore. And I went to school at the York Elementary School off of Lock Raven Boulevard. The other day I actually used Google map, you know, Google Earth, to find the school, and it's still there. You know, I actually saw, you know, I found it, and I could see it. They had a Google Maps that showed it, and then I went to the street view and I could see it, and it had hardly changed at all. But the thing was, you know, Baltimore in those days was a very tough place, and I had to leave our apartment and walk to York Elementary School, and always there were these big kids who would like terrorize all the little kids. And so I learned how to like be sneaky, you know, and I would try to get to school, not be seen, not be noticed, and I learned how to like try to be invisible. I think that habit really stayed with me for a long time. You know, I was constantly in my interactions with other people, I was always waiting to get beaten up. You know, long after those bullies were gone, I think I was in high school and I was still trying to be invisible because I was afraid people were going to beat me up, even people who didn't want to beat me up. So, you know, this is what's really meant by karma. you know, we carry these things with us very deeply. We may have forgotten the sources of this, you know. You know, they stay with us. And a lot of koan training is working through these karmic obstacles that are very deeply embedded in our mental habits. When you begin to work through these karmic obstacles, you know, you really begin to experience the world in this different way. You know, if you could imagine, you know, we tend to experience the world in like a fragment of the world or a piece of a bigger picture, but we tend to focus only on the little piece. You know, as you do Zen practice, you begin to get what you could say is a more full picture of what reality is really like. And everyday reality is real, but it's only part of something bigger. Yeah? And so, you know, a lot of Zen practice you could think of is filling in these missing spaces in our picture of the world, which is basically a bigger world than our discriminating minds, our thinking minds can reveal to us. So, you know, a lot of advanced Zen practice is quite difficult because you have to have very, very high, very refined awareness to work with the koan. So, you know, usually with advanced koans, you can't really do them in everyday practice. It really takes 3 or 4 days of sustained concentration before your mind is open enough and your consciousness is clear enough to engage with the koan and really have be ready for this inner transformation process. If you've been to Sesshin, you know what I mean. You know, by day 3 or day 4 of Sesshin, your mind is really in a different place. Here on a Saturday sit too, you know, if you came early in the morning, by now, you know, you've been sitting for many hours and your mind is in a very different place than it was when you came in. So now, you know, the mind is ready to do this kind of deeper, more challenging practice after many hours of stabilization and focusing and working through obstacles. You know, some koans are really about grasping the fundamental nature of the moment without any kind of screen or assumption getting in the way. It's like having to look very, very, very carefully to notice something in the moment that most people overlook. You know, this really isn't like science fiction, you know. I have had the experience of sitting in my office and hearing a bird and talking to somebody and saying, "Do you hear that bird?" And they didn't notice it at all. You know, there might be a bird in my right outside my window, and it's singing this beautiful song. And I'll say to somebody, "Did you hear that bird?" And they'll go, "What bird?" They're so caught up in their thinking, you know, that they don't even notice this is going on. You know, if you're very distracted and you eat something, you might not even taste it, right? You know. So if your consciousness is too closed in on itself, it's hard to be truly aware of what's going on around us. Well, this is the same. This is also true with Zen. You know, if you do 3 days of Zazen, your senses are in a very acute, open, and alert condition that is really not achievable, say, in 20 minutes of sitting. And in that condition, you know, more advanced Zen practice involves reporting on how the moment really is without these obstacles, you know. So, you know, basically, if you begin to really refine your consciousness and open your awareness, you know, you notice many things about the moment that you might have overlooked at other times. So this is that. Now to the koan. in the last minute, I will actually discuss the koan. What is Buddha? A monk asked Tozan, what is Buddha? Tozan said, 3 chain of flax. Well, this koan is, this is like a classic koan, because it doesn't want to be answered by thinking. So if you try to think it through, you can't answer it. You have to internalize the koan like a mantra. So you basically sit down on the cushion, get to that calm, balanced place, and you say, you could actually say flax. You might not know what flax is, but flax is like burlap. Burlap is a very crude kind of flax. Linen is a very refined kind of flax. So what is Buddha? 3 chin is like a, like you could say 3 grades or 3 layers of flax, you could say. And flax is like burlap or like linen. So the answer is 3 layers of linen. It's obviously nonsense to the thinking mind, but you have to internalize this like a mantra. So you could just say flax, 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 see. And this is processed unconsciously, you know, by your bigger mind, by your unconscious mind. And it begins to transform the way you experience some aspect of the moment. And it requires, a koan like this is a very, very advanced koan, and it requires deep concentration, incredible concentration. And in that process of concentration, you need to use your whole being, and not just your conscious mind, but your unconscious mind and your body. You know, believe it or not, when we do zazen, even though we're immobilizing the body, we're activating the whole nervous system. This is really true. You know, there are koans that require you to be aware of parts of your body, believe it or not. You know, there are koans that actually activate your senses, your awareness of parts of your body. I'm not kidding. So that you give the person the koan, and then, 4 days later during sesshin, they come in and they might say something about a part of their body being very excited about something. I'm not going to give you any details. But the point is that the whole being is drawn into Zen practice. And not just the conscious mind, but the unconscious mind, and this body, all of which is like one big system for enlightenment. You know, if Zen is like a school for cultivating awareness, the human body is, from the Buddhist standpoint, like a machine for enlightenment. You know, everything we need to be awake is in our equipment set, you know. This body, this mind, and this with this beautiful unconscious mind. All the tools we need to wake up are right here in this body, in this mind. So, today we came to cultivate the great way and to work through our obstacles and open our lives to this beautiful world around us. So thanks. Thank you for doing it. A monk asked Tozan, what is Buddha? Tozan replied, 3 layers of flax. Mumon's comment, old Tozan attained the poor Zen of a clam. He opened the 2 halves of the shell a little and exposed all of his liver and intestines inside. So remember, in Zen, you don't want people to be egotistical. So you never say, in classical Zen, nobody would ever say, Tozan is such a great Zen master. See, that in Zen, people won't go, oh, you're so good. That might encourage you, you know, to be sort of arrogant or narcissistic. So when in Zen, when somebody pays you a compliment, they might say, "You're really a blockhead," you know, and you should say, "Thanks, you know, thank you." Old Tozan attained the poor Zen of a clam. In other words, Old Tozan was a great Zen master. He was able to open himself up to the universe just as a clam opens its shell to the ocean. See, that's what they're really saying. But tell me, how do you see Tozan? Umon's verse. 3 pounds of flax came sweeping along. Close were the words, but closer was the meaning. In other words, you really have to be aware. Your mind has to be quite open to deal with this koan. And that those who argue about right and wrong are enslaved by right and wrong. So the koan's really saying, don't live too much in your thinking mind. It's a big world out there, and it's really quite wonderful.